Good afternoon, everyone. Calling this February 14th meeting of the Tax Committee to order. First up, Representative Norris, have you had a chance to review the February 9th minutes?
Diligently, Chair Gomez.
And would you like to move that we adopt them?
I would. I'll move approval of the February 9th meeting minutes.
All right. Representative Norris has moved approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Any opposed, please say no. Minutes are adopted. All right. We have two bills on our agenda today. First up is House File 1488. Representative Joachim is going to move that House File 1488 be laid over for possible inclusion. Hello. Welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move your author's amendment before we get into it?
Yes, Madam Chair. I do have an A2 author's amendment because I, too, believe that there should be purpose statements in bills. So I had one drafted for this one, and that's in the A2 amendment.
Excellent. Is there any discussion on the A2 which adds a purpose statement to this bill? Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it the Chair's prerogative that we'll do this for all potential tax bills, or because I know Representative Abajay had a bill or a comment to potentially do that.
Thank you, Representative Swedzinski, for the question. So Representative Abajay had a bill that brought forward some purpose statements. We do have a policy that we've adopted of adding purpose statements to expenditures. So any tax expenditure, definitely it's my hope and expectation, to the extent that we're hearing them, that they have purpose statements, partially at least, in order to help the Tax Expenditure Review Commission that we heard about in one of our first sessions, allowing them to do their work of evaluating the effectiveness of the items in our tax expenditure budget. So, definitely purpose statements are welcome on tax expenditures in the House Tax Committee. Anything further, Rep? Okay. All right. So Representative Joachim has moved the A2 amendment. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, please say no.
No.
And the A2 amendment is adopted. House File 1488 is in the form the author would like. Representative Joachim, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. The Minnesota Historic Tax Credit has been in existence since 2010 and aligns itself with the Federal Historic Tax Credit. I would like to thank the many folks that have worked on this credit in the past and who have supported it over the years, as well as those on the committee who've signed on to the bill this year with Representative David, Representative Olsonell, and then I believe also Representative Brandt. So the historic tax credit had been set to sunset in 2011. It was given a one-year reprieve, and then last year's tax bill that was included a removal of the 2022 sunset. we know what happened to that, and unfortunately with the tax bill's demise, the program was abruptly discontinued. The tax committee has continued the work reviewing the effectiveness and return on investment for tax expenditures. What is nice about this particular tax expenditure is that we have the data. Every year, the University of Minnesota Extension Services does a thorough report on the economic impact of this credit. You should have the latest report in your packet. There are different sets of data points I would like you to look at. One is the data from the 2022 projects. The other is the data from the life of the program from 2011 to 2022. And you'll also see some really good summaries of the different projects that it has been used for just this last year. The economic impact of the projects leveraged by the Minnesota Historic Tax Credit for 2022 alone include $349.8 million of future economic activity generated from the projects, supporting 1,300 jobs, and then $209.9 million spending planned by the project developers. And on average, about 35% of the credit costs are repaid immediately after completed construction. The report also notes that for every dollar of tax credit created, $9.90 of economic activity to the state. And that's in form of expanded property tax, increased income taxes on the job, the folks that are working the jobs. The data for the 10-year life of the project includes $5.9 billion in economic activity, 29,570 jobs that paid $2.2 billion in labor income. 20 Minnesota counties have had projects, and while half of the projects are in Ramsey and Hennepin counties, there are also high numbers of projects in St. Louis County, Winona, Otter Tail, and Stearns. Another benefit of rehabbing older buildings is that the majority of costs actually go into labor versus buying new material for new construction. The historic tax credit stabilizes and defines the unique characters of our main streets across our communities, especially in our small towns across the state. The construction workforce is employed on a historic tax credit also reach way beyond the borders of the city where the project's being done. For example, projects that took place in Minneapolis and St. Paul proper still had reached beyond their borders with crews coming from throughout the greater 15 county metropolitan area. The historic tax credit creates opportunities for small business entrepreneurship and development, as well as results in new employment opportunities in the completed buildings. I have a variety of letters of support in your packet, and I have the few testifiers here to walk through the bill and explain the benefits of reinstating the historic tax credit. They will each only be taking a few minutes, and I believe we are first starting out with a very short video from Revitalize Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative
Joachim. Heidi Swank?
Yes.
Yeah, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Heidi Swank. I am the executive director of Rethos and president of the Revitalize MN Coalition. We are a coalition of architects and community members and old building lovers and developers who have been advocating for the Minnesota Historic Tax Credit for several sessions now. Minnesota's Historic Tax Credit ended last June following a one-year extension of a program that was first established by the legislature as part of a jobs bill in 2010. The Historic Tax Credits Program offered a 20% income tax credit for the rehabilitation of buildings that are listed on the National Register of Historic Places, a pretty high bar. It is important to note that this credit's not paid out until the end of the project. That means that should a project be undertaken, money is not put at risk until that project is completed and paid out when the building is put into service. Therefore, not only is the public money safeguarded, but this tax credit enables a building to be put back onto the property tax rolls, thereby increasing public dollars available for schools, libraries, and the like in perpetuity. Our state program has mirrored the federal program that has been in place since the 1980s and is a permanent part of the federal tax code. The program is administered by the State Historic Preservation Office at the Department of Administration in partnership with the National Park Service, which administers the National Historic Preservation Act. According to the National Trust for Historic Preservation, 37 states have some sort of incentive to encourage historic rehabilitation redevelopment. Minnesota was among these states until the program sunset in July 2022. We are excited at the possibility of bringing this tool back to our state. With that, I would like to play a brief video for you that Revitalize MN developed in 2021. Please know that the numbers in this video are from the previous year and may not match the newer numbers that you are hearing and seeing in other places today.
There's only a small area of downtown Ely that really has that historical small town feel as you drive through before it sort of opens up again. You start at Central Avenue coming into town and then you get to the top of the hill, and this theater and the marquee are right there. They're what draw you in. And for a lot of years, driving by the marquee was a little sad, you know, that you knew it wasn't going to be lit up. And I think pretty much everyone in town who grew up here has a story of sitting in this theater, having rain fall on their head, having a ceiling tile fall on them, having a chair break while they were sitting in it.
Particularly if it was raining, you had to be careful because it was also dripping down on you and it would be running down the aisles. The theater was just in very, very poor condition. I had owned a business on this block actually since 1998 and had seen the block kind of go quiet after the theater closed in 2007. I think the community as a whole took it pretty hard. We always want our storefronts open. I mean, a town, in order to be alive and functioning, you need your stores occupied and open.
There are so many reasons to preserve historic structures. If you take a certain amount of money and you build a new building with it, you will spend most of your money on materials. If you take that same amount of money and spend it on restoration, you will spend a lot of your money on labor. So the labor will stimulate your local economy, whether it's your local tradesmen and workmen, or whether you actually get people from the outside who come in and stay in your hotels and restaurants.
When you drive by and you see the local plumbers, local electricians, you recognize all the trucks, you know that's a good thing. To match the existing details, to take it that extra mile and use the original woodwork, doing that was a really big deal, and I think kept the heart and character of a project like this that'll last a lot longer than a complete overhaul not being true to any of those details.
There were buildings that were built in the 20s and 30s that will never be duplicated again. No one will put that kind of craftsmanship and style and materials into a building because it's just too expensive.
In these smaller communities, it means so much more because it can be the economic driver behind revitalizing the whole downtown area, for example.
Having this restoration project in itself was a boon to Ely, but now, with the new layout and the additional space that's been opened up in the building next door, it will be very, very useful for upcoming events.
All right. Thank you for that. Does that conclude your testimony, Ms. Swank?
It does.
Thank you. Next, is it for this testifier? If you wouldn't mind, Ms. Swank, would you just answer a question quick before you take off? Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question on kind of the video. It talked a little bit about the project itself, but like, could you walk a little bit of actually how it worked? So like, how much was local money? How much was the tax credit for, as far as they utilized it? Did the company that did it, did they sell the tax credit? Did they utilize the tax credit themselves, particularly on this project?
Ms. Swank.
And thank you for that question. I don't have those numbers off the top of my head for the Ely State Theater, but I am happy to pull them together and send them to the chair and the commission if that's
great.
Appropriate.
Great. That sounds great, and we'll just send that out to you as follow-up. Thank you, Ms. Swank. Next up is Justin Fincher. And on deck is Megan Elliott, if you could just get ready to come up next. Welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with a couple minutes of testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Justin Fincher. I'm with J.B. Vang Partners. We're a small BIPOC developer located in St. Paul. We've been in business for over 15 years, and we've created a niche towards working with purpose-driven organizations and projects which have strong positive impacts in our community. The Twin Cities and Minnesota overall had an incredible program with the State Historic Tax Credit. The tax credit enables developers like J.B. Vang to partner with our communities and to preserve and reuse these precious historical assets. This program creates jobs within our communities, not just for the tradespeople, but for local developers, architects, engineers, and much more. At J.B. Vang, part of our mission is to invest in our communities with a focus on sustainability. This historic tax credit program helps us to achieve those goals. We also prioritize supporting local entrepreneurs and local commerce through each of our projects. As of recently, Our firm has been selected as tentative developer status for the Hams Brewery complex here in St. Paul, which includes buildings going back as far as the mid to late 1800s. Our proposal includes utilizing the state historic program to reuse this complex and the surrounding site into a mix of residential and commercial uses, with a keen emphasis on building equity in our community through a mix of housing types, owner-occupied housing, and mixed-income apartments, as well as providing a community-minded marketplace with an emphasis on providing business owners the opportunity to own their individual share of that marketplace. In addition to this focus, our team has assembled a mix of community-minded public realm components, such as a programmable outdoor green space, an open-air plaza, indoor and outdoor play areas, and other exciting features to come. The State Historic Program provides much-needed support for us to be able to offer these features, which we know will be a key asset in the community. Historic tax credit projects not only create jobs, but they also create value for their communities. Every dollar of tax credit invested in historic redevelopment projects creates nearly $10 of economic activity, a tenfold ROI that directly benefits local communities. The State Historic Program has also provided our firm with additional pathways to finance two recent projects: the conversion of a historic office building into a Korean immersion elementary school, and the conversion of a historic office warehouse structure into mixed-income affordable housing community.
Did you just finish up, Mr. Fincher? I'm sorry.
I can confidently tell you these projects would not have happened without the State Historic Program. I'm here to testify in favor of renewing this critical resource for small developers and allow us to continue making positive changes in our community.
Thank you very much. Before you leave, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question maybe for the audience, and the question is there anybody that opposes this bill? Testifying against it. Well, then, Madam Chair, it looks to me like everything's been said. It's just not everybody said it. So,
yep, we're going to try to keep it brief. Our future testifiers, thank you for that. Representative Davids.
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Up next, Megan Elliott. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm going to talk really fast. Well, at your request.
Not for Representative Davids.
Madam Chair, now yes, we're making progress. This is progress.
All right, great. That's what we call progress. Ms. Elliott, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Megan Elliott. I typically wear three hats in the building reuse industry. Today, I'm going to ask you if I can wear four. My first hat is as a co-founding member of Revitalize MN, along with Heidi Swank and others. The reason we started this group was to gather all the voices across the state of Minnesota. As Heidi mentioned, it's architects, but also tradespeople, building owners, and I want to add cities and public entities that see this as an important economic development tool. My second hat, I am an entrepreneur. I started a company called New History 10 years ago. We solely focus on revitalizing historic buildings and sites across the state of Minnesota. And in the 10 years that I've had that company, we've worked on almost 300 projects in almost 40 communities across the state, from public parks to rural redevelopment to downtown development. My third hat that I wear is I'm a real estate developer. I like to call them high potential historic properties. That means really hard. I just finished my first project under this new company called Jill Pine, and that was the redevelopment of a long vacant county jail in Duluth, now known as Leona. We converted that building into workforce housing. And I will tell you that with only 10% of real estate leadership being women, breaking into real estate development was almost as hard as converting 99 jail cells into housing. The fourth hat that I want to wear for you this afternoon is as a technical expert, I am happy to ask those nitty-gritty questions about how these credits work. As a consultant and a real estate developer, I can go as deep into the weeds as you need me to. I'm only going to make 2 points. I know we're brief on time. I want to emphasize that this credit gets used by a lot of different communities for a lot of different project types. So just on my desk right now at New History, we're working with the Seward Redesign, nonprofit developer in Minneapolis, to redevelop the Coliseum building on East Lake Street for a BIPOC community entrepreneurship hub. We're working with a small nonprofit arts group in Le Sueur to restore a theater. And we've been working literally for years in Duluth with the Duluth Armory Group to redevelop that building into marketplace, office, and clean manufacturing.
Final couple sentences, Ms. Elliott.
Sorry?
Just if you could conclude your testimony shortly. We're at your 2 minutes.
My second point is that this project, this program gets used across the state of Minnesota. I'm not going to repeat the statistics that Representative Joachim gave you, but they were, I think, demonstrate how powerful this tool is. And I'll just leave you with, I'm happy to answer questions, particularly around the nuts and bolts of how this program works.
Thank you. Next up is Claire Vander Eyck.
Hi, thank you guys. I promise not to belabor this point, but Madam Chair and committee members, I so appreciate and thank you so much for sponsoring this bill today. My name is Claire Vander Eyck. I am a senior development manager with Schaefer Richardson, and I specialize in affordable housing. Schaefer Richardson has a strong reputation of delivering high quality urban infill projects throughout the upper Midwest. But our roots are really in adaptive reuse of historic buildings into housing in the Warehouse District of Minneapolis. Personally, I hold a master's degree in historic preservation. I serve on the Minneapolis Heritage Preservation Commission, and I consider myself a preservationist first and a developer second. I grew up in St. Cloud, Minnesota, and I currently reside in South Minneapolis. I could spend my time today speaking to the statistics that have already been spoken to, which I think are incredibly important, as to how economically impactful this tax credit is, and specifically how it's a game changer for spurring investment in old buildings across the state of Minnesota. But instead, I'd like to highlight some benefits that I think are a little less easily quantified. The very reason I sit before you today and the reason my career has shaped the way that it has up to this point is because of historic preservation. I've always felt a special affinity with buildings, not just because I like architecture, but I feel very deeply the connection that buildings have to the strength of our communities. Our built environment can have a direct impact on the strength of a community and the community that inhabits it. And it's just simply true that neighborhoods, their design prior to the proliferation of vehicle transportation was more condensed and inherently supported deeper community connections. These are the type of buildings that the State Historic Tax Credit can help preserve. There are buildings all across the state of Minnesota, both in urban and rural communities, that will benefit through thoughtful investment that can extend their useful life, even when that means that their very use must be completely redefined in order to meet the current needs of the community. Without the State Historic Tax Credit, those projects will not happen. Most of those projects will not happen. The built environment impacts each of us every single day, whether or not we're keyed into it or not. My statement to you today is that we as developers and investors and as elected leaders have the responsibility to ensure that these buildings support strong communities, and I ask that you support the State Historic Tax Credit.
Thank you, Ms. Vander Eyck. Excuse me. Next up is Michelle Baltus-Priebel. Oh, sorry. Representative Olson, did you have a question for the last testifier?
No, Madam Chair, it's not necessarily for the one testifier. It was maybe if I could just ask a question to the future testifiers. So I have a master's in history. I know that, you know, what I find very influential in history may be different from what another individual who has a master's in history sees as historic. I think what would be very beneficial to this committee is, what does the application process look like? All I'm seeing here is that they have to verify eligibility for the credit or grant. Can we get some of the stipulations as to what fits within this, how it's provided? Something towards that. Does it have to be on the National Historic Register? Does it have to be on the State Historic Register? Who decides which of these, what is history and what is not history? That would be very beneficial to me.
So if the testifiers coming up could tell us what is and is not history. No, I'm just kidding. No, I appreciate that. If folks who are coming up testifying have comments, but also we're going to have time for some conversation, so maybe we'll revisit once the testifiers are done if there's sort of some more specific questions you have about the application process and other items. So thank you for that. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your 2 minutes of testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Gomez and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Baltus-Priebel, and I lead the housing studio at LHB, a Duluth and Minneapolis-based architecture and engineering firm. I'm here on behalf of the American Institute of Architects of Minnesota in support of this House file. I know you've heard from developers of many different types of projects that benefit from this important tax credit. I want to testify today to make sure the impact of the credit on Minnesota's affordable housing stock is clear to the committee. LHB has long dedicated a significant portion of our practice to the design of healthy, sustainable, resilient, affordable housing. In the past two decades, our firm and its partners have utilized the Historic Preservation Tax Credit on 12 significant projects that cumulatively created or preserved nearly 700 units of affordable housing around the state. Some of these may not have happened without the Historic Preservation Tax Credit. The projects rehabilitated existing buildings, giving them new life and avoiding the cost, waste, and environmental burdens that would come with teardowns or new construction on greenfield sites. These projects are also embedded within existing community infrastructure, from transit and childcare to supportive services and healthcare, which increase the likelihood that residents of the affordable housing can build stability for themselves and their families. As policymakers, you know how challenging it is to assemble funding for affordable housing. We need every tool in the toolbox to create more of the housing our Minnesota communities desperately need. Restoring this tax credit will help firms like mine work with developers to create more affordable housing in existing buildings and help communities give the assets they already have new life. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up, Nicole Goodman. So we have about 15 minutes left for this bill. We do want to leave some time for member questions and conversation with the author. So if you're testifying, if we could keep it pretty brief. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Goodman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be brief. My name is Nicole Goodman, and I'm the Director of the Department of Planning and Economic Development with the City of St. Paul. I'm here today to testify in support of this tax file. Of this historic tax credits, as you know, have long been a critical element in the financing structure of many important redevelopment projects in St. Paul and throughout Minnesota. These projects breathe new life into structures with great historic significance to our communities. The buildings are often vacant and dilapidated before redevelopment, which contributes to community concerns and blight in the neighborhoods in which they are located. While the projects are in progress, work is created for architects, engineers, and laborers. And after the projects are complete, not only have these important pieces of architecture been saved, but jobs have been created, housing supply has often been added, and the local tax base has increased. Renovating historic structures to meet today's building codes and services is very costly, and the tax credit is typically a necessary piece of the financial equation, meaning the project would not be financially feasible. It would not happen without the availability of the tax credits. As mentioned, the tax credits are not earned until the projects are complete, so there's no risk involved. If the tax credit is given, that means the project was completed and the positive impacts have been and will continue to be realized. In closing, historic buildings and their aesthetic features are a part of what make every city and town unique. Preserving them is a high priority, not only for their historic value, but as mentioned here, as an important economic development tool as well. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Next up, Adam Dunick. On deck, we have Sean Smith. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And the time sitting over here, I cut about five paragraphs from my testimony really quick.
Thank you for that.
My name is Adam Dunick. I'm here on behalf of the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. And today I'm here because this bill is a jobs bill to us. Since its inception in 2011, the historic tax credit is responsible for over 29,000 jobs across the state. In 2022 alone, it's responsible for over 1,200 jobs just in the construction field. And last year, the credit generated $95 million in labor income. Construction job creation of this type also supports our gold standard apprenticeship programs, which lead the way in recruiting women, minorities, and veterans and other folks who are not represented in the construction trade into the trade, which is a great way for us to do outreach and grow our construction market. Lastly, I just want to say the Carpenters Union stands strongly in support of programs like these for the reasons I laid out, and happy to stand for questions or support the author as we move forward.
Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Dunick. Oh, now where's my sheet? Next up, sorry, Sean Smith. Welcome to the committee. And on deck is Amy Spong or Sponge. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name. Spong. He just told me. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the Tax Committee. My name is Sean Smith. I am the Public Policy Committee Chair for NAOP Minnesota. We are the leading organization for commercial real estate owners and developers. And in this role, I am serving as a volunteer today. Our members really view themselves as providing the physical infrastructure for all the businesses that operate in the state of Minnesota. There are many, many, many things to like about this credit, and all of which have all been said. One thing I'd like to remind all of you of is historically, this credit has gained broad bipartisan and bicameral support. And so on top of all of the other great things that have been said on this, I would just like to say thank you, Chair and Rep. Youakim, for being the author and the co-authors as well, and I appreciate the time allocated today for this testimony.
Thank you very much. Thanks for being with us. Finally, Amy Spong. Spong, excuse me. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and committee members. I'm Amy Spong, Deputy State Historic Preservation Officer and Director of the State Historic Preservation Office. Thank you. A lot of the benefits of the program have been already stated, so I won't repeat that. I will mention that over the 12 years that we've had a State Historic Tax Credit in Minnesota, we've approved 193 projects. We've been averaging about 12, just over a dozen projects a year. And since the program sunset in 2022, we have had 3 applications for the federal-only credit. So the federal credit is still an active program that we administer with the National Park Service and the IRS. I'm happy to speak to the question about process a little bit and some of the eligibility requirements. In order to get the state historic tax credit, you have to receive the federal historic tax credit. And so the general eligibility requirements for the federal credit is that the building is listed on the National Register or determined eligible for the National Register. That is a separate program that our office administers along with the National Park Service as well. We go through a board review process, recommendations are made, and then ultimately it's the keeper of the National Register at the Park Service that determines what gets listed as being eligible on the National Register. There's very broad criteria for being able to be listed on the National Register, and there's a whole host of property types that are identified and considered significant for the National Register. There is a three-part process on the application process on the federal side. Part of that is determining that significance or eligibility status of the building, and then the rehab standards. Another major eligibility requirement is that the project, the rehab, must meet federal standards and guidelines, and that's namely the amount of the work that we do with the National Park Service is determining whether the rehab standards are being met.
Thank you very much, and thanks for addressing Representative Olson's question. If you wouldn't mind just sticking around, if we can go to Representative Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for the information on that. I really appreciate it. One quick question about the National Historic Register or the State's Register. Once you're on, is it nearly impossible to get off? Basically, what happens, I mean, we're fixing up an old historic building, and then 80 years from now, it needs to be fixed up again. Are we going to run into, is this like a self-perpetuating prophecy that we're going to continue to need these historic credits into perpetuity due to the fact that we're required to continue keeping these historic sites up, which I am for. I'm a history buff, big history buff, so I am for that. I'm just curious.
Ms. Spong.
Chair Gomez and committee member. I'm sorry, if you could just repeat your...
Representative Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Is it possible to get off the National Historic Register?
Ms. Spong.
Thank you, Representative. Yes, we have actually delisted some properties over time. Sometimes they are not maintained, and they've lost their integrity, so to speak, or they have been demolished. And so, unfortunately, we do have to delist some properties at times. Yes.
Anything further, Representative Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, so we're going to go to member conversation now. Representative Brand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I spent a lot of time in Ely, and I was actually in that theater when you could actually see the ceiling tiles fall down, and you could see those pictures. That was still in operation at that point. It was really sad. It could have been demolished, but I actually haven't seen the inside of it since, but I know that they had done some work. What a difference. That thing looks as good as the day that it was built and opened up to the public. And I think that that speaks a lot to the community and the support of the community, but also this program itself. And that is like a boots on the ground way to show that this is actually working. So I appreciate the opportunity to see what that looked like before again, to remind myself from about 20 years ago, and then now to see what it looks like now. It's just amazing difference.
you. Representative Swedzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question, we had some comments about the creating affordable housing. Do we have any history as far as that development and how long those properties stay in affordable housing? Do they, you know, after, is there a certain time period that if they're, you know, created for affordable housing, get approved through the, that they stay affordable housing, or do 10 years later after being rented out, then they become higher value projects, or any, what's kind of the history there? Or could any of the developers speak to that?
I can go to the author and some testifiers. I guess I'll say, and I know we have the housing chair here, just that putting together financing for affordable housing is obviously like super complicated, and different funding sources will have different requirements in terms of the affordability term is what they call it. I know that like that we switched, I don't want to say it wrong. The two numbers 30 and 15 are in my head. And so I know that when I was at the city that we had an affordable, the city of Minneapolis, for example, we had an affordable housing trust fund that was funded by, you know, general fund property tax levy money that the city put aside, and that we changed the requirement from, you know, 15 to 30 years of affordability when I was there. That's just an example though. But I know that it takes like sometimes a dozen sources of funding to put together an affordable housing project, especially talking about deeply affordable housing, which is affordable at 30% of AMI, which is sort of where there's the most need. But I don't know, but you know, there's a bunch of developers in the room, so they probably know better than I. If there's specifics about projects that have been funded using the historic rehab credit, and if there is the requirement when it's being used for housing, if, that there's an affordability term associated with that. Thank you.
Yeah. Claire Vanderake with Schaefer Richardson. And again, I specialize in affordable housing, so happy to answer some of that questions. You know, not every historic tax credit project is an affordable housing project, of course, and not every adaptive use project goes into housing. The reason that you often see those two paired is because they do kind of financially meld together quite well. You're seeking the same type of investors. So to answer your question about the length of period, that's really dictated by the organization with which you're getting the tax credits from. So as Madam Chair noted, the City of Minneapolis provides tax credits, and they may dictate terms as to, depending on what financing sources you're pursuing, as to how long that affordability period is. As Chair Gomez noted, generally speaking, it's for a minimum of 15 years. That's a federal requirement. But generally speaking, our communities have largely moved to a minimum of 30 years. We have a 15-year initial use period plus another 15-year extended use period, in which point that those income and rent restrictions stay in place. We've also seen communities across the country extend that even further as we've seen the need for affordable housing deepen. So generally speaking, you're going to see the commitments for at least 15 years, but more often than not, now we'll see them be 30.
Thank you, Ms. Vander Eyck. Representative Swedzinski, is that good for you? Okay. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Joaquim, for bringing this bill. I've long been a supporter of this, but I did just have a question. I see that in Section 4.1, you are repealing the sunset, and even though I really love this program, I also really love sunsets because I think it's good for us to reevaluate every 5 or 10 years how we're spending the state's money. So I just wondered if you could speak to why you are taking out the repealer. Thank you.
Thank you,
Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Robbins. It's where that credit was actually structured, is in that statute with the sunset, so we want to remove the sunset. I know folks in the room would like to have this not to have to come up every year to fight for this, but I do know in other parts of our statute we have an automatic 8-year sunset on projects, so that will be a point of discussion for the chair and the committee.
Thank you. Yeah, and so in 2021 we did adopt a policy of an 8-year sunset for all new tax expenditures. So I will just say that it's my intention to move forward with that. You know, obviously we're going to be, you know, I want to honor that part of statute that we negotiated and signed into law. So, you know, as usual with these bills that we're laying over for possible inclusion, there are tweaks that can happen to them as we're moving forward. And we'll be discussing that, I'm sure, more about expenditures sunsetting. So thank you for bringing that up, Representative Robbins.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Joachim.
Thank you. While I do appreciate the statute, too, I would like to have some consideration of making it a little bit longer for this in particular, because it takes, now that we've stopped it, it's going to take a while for it to start up again, for folks to start applying, and to have the stability of funding for projects moving forward, since currently the bill is drafted to be a one-year lump sum after it's in process. The governor's bill, I believe, has a five-year time, so maybe even thinking, if not 8 years, at least 5 years, you could get those two five-year cycles in. So it's just something to throw out there. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion to the bill? All right. I'm not seeing any. Representative Joachim, did you have any closing comments for us?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'll just make it brief. Thank you all for the discussion, members, and the questions. The historic tax credit plays an important role in our communities. It has data back to back up how successful it has been in spurring the economic development that adds to our community property tax base. Data that shows creating jobs increase our income tax for our general fund. And also, in the bottom line, it enhances our communities with vibrancy with each project by retaining the historic structure. I would love to have your support for this bill as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And with that, Rep. Joachim will move that House File 1488 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion, and the bill is laid over. Thank you. Next up is House File 1487. Representative Ryer, welcome to the committee. Chair is going to move that House File 1487 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. To Representative Ryer, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. It's good to be here. House File 1487 is a bill focused on consumer rights and the appropriate use of government services. This bill limits the use of state resources by private companies, removing the option for collecting medical debt by garnishing individuals' tax returns. At present, some private nonprofit hospitals, specifically those that lease their buildings from their city or county, are allowed to submit claims to the State of Minnesota Department of Revenue. The department diverts the person's tax return to that hospital to cover medical debt. Ambulance services are also covered by this program. The Department of Revenue receives $15 per claim, four of which goes to the administration, and the balance, which adds about $272,000 per year to the general fund. Bottom line, our state budget is being enriched at the expense of Minnesotans who are struggling financially. The program was set up as an expedient way to get money to hospitals when the uninsured rate was much higher. Many more people were using ERs for routine care, and uncompensated care was at a crisis level. It was expanded to ambulance services to address unsustainably low reimbursements. There are a number of problems with this. First, I don't think the government system should be used to collect non-government debt. This is an inappropriate use of our resources. Second, there are few safeguards in consumer protections. For example, there's no verification by the Department of Revenue about the accuracy of the claim. Finally, and most importantly, this program harms the people who can least afford it, lower-income working people. This is a hard place to be in our society. Many work multiple jobs to scrape by and earn just a bit too much to qualify for public health care programs. More than 750,000 Minnesotans have medical debt in collections, and too many end up in bankruptcy. Their tax returns are an annual chance to get ahead, pay some bills, or take care of pressing home maintenance. This is a crushing blow and often comes as an unwelcome surprise. At the same time, hospitals and ambulances are necessary and do not come to us free. Now, the healthcare system isn't set up in a way that truly covers the cost of providing services. As a state, we must take on these structural problems. And in the meantime, we need to get the burden off the backs of the people in our state. Now I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers to share more about the bill and its benefits. Thank you. I'll look forward to your questions and ask for your support.
Thank you very much, Representative Ryer. First up, Anna Odegaard. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay.
You're good. The mic's a little low, so if you could just make sure to speak up so Representative Koznick can hear you and he stops texting me about the mics. and just your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee. My name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. We are a statewide coalition of nonprofit organizations committed to ensuring equitable asset building opportunities for low-income and BIPOC communities throughout our state. I'd like to thank Representative Ryer for taking the lead on this important bill and all of our wonderful co-authors who are too numerous to name here. In 2019, one of MABC's members shared with our advisory council that a client of his had incurred significant hospital debt from a health crisis, had set up a payment plan with the hospital, and was current on her payments. She was shocked, therefore, when her entire tax refund was seized through revenue recapture to pay her hospital debt. I was also surprised to hear this because I know the agreement between Minnesota hospitals and the Attorney General prohibits hospitals from referring patient debt to collections if payments are being made on a payment plan. A little research revealed that the agreement with the AG intended to protect patients from overly aggressive medical debt collection doesn't apply to the revenue recapture process. The bill handout in your packets includes a chart of a few of the most significant protections that apply to regular debt collection but not to revenue recapture. We also learned from data provided by the Minnesota Department of Revenue that the majority of revenue recapture claims for medical bills are against low-income households. Some of these patients were uninsured, others had health insurance with high deductibles. A health crisis is expensive for most families, not only in medical bills, but often in lost wages as well. The AG agreement and other statutory protections relating to third-party debt collection are intended to protect these families like these. And we object to revenue recapture specifically because it circumvents these protections and causes harm to the most financially vulnerable families in our communities. Most of Minnesota's hospitals don't use revenue recapture, either because they're not eligible or because they recognize the harm to their patients. Some hospitals and ambulance services that serve a disproportionate share of public program patients or offer more uncompensated care may need to seek alternate sources of revenue if revenue recapture is eliminated. Some alternatives under discussion, such as an uncompensated care pool for EMS services, are much preferable from our standpoint to continuing revenue recapture because they avoid causing harm to families who are already struggling and who may forego necessary care because they are worried about taking on more debt. Minnesota and South Carolina are the only states that take individual tax refunds on behalf of private healthcare companies. Let's make South Carolina the only one. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Odegaard. Before you leave, Representative Davids, did you have a question?
Yes, several, actually.
We have a few more testifiers, so if it's general, then we're going to save it, but if you have a specific question.
It's not general.
Great.
Yeah, it's to the testifier.
Sounds
Thank
good.
You, Madam Chair. I was kind of curious. The people have the money. They have a tax refund coming. They have the money, but you're saying they don't have to pay their ambulance bill. Are there any other bills? Do you have a list of other bills that they shouldn't have to pay, or is it just ambulance bills?
Madam Chair?
Ms. Odegaard.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Davids, for that question. You know, we are not arguing that hospitals or ambulance services shouldn't use third-party debt collection just like other private entities that are collecting debts that are collecting consumer debt. Just that there are protections built into the statutory regulations around third-party debt collections that make sure that the most financially vulnerable families have some protection, have some income that is not eligible to be garnished, for instance, that they have to have a judgment in a court, so there's some due process for those families. We want those protections to apply, and the problem is that they don't apply to revenue recapture.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier, let me think here now. So you go through the revenue recapture, or you go to a third-party collection agency. Do either one of those affect your credit score?
Ms. Odegaard.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Davids. Revenue recapture does not affect a person's credit score. There have been federal changes recently within the last year really limiting the extent to which other kinds of medical debt do hit your credit score, but some of them do.
Well, Representative
well,
Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find it curious that this bill would support ruining people's credit scores when the way it is today. It doesn't. To the witness, do you object to the state of Minnesota being able to use revenue recapture for medical debt such as for Minnesota Care?
So we're going to keep I don't think the opinion of the testifier about whether
she's pretty smart
about something that's outside the purview of the bill is really relevant. I mean, I think you want to make a statement about.
Okay. Well, I'll wait.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Ms. Odegaard. We're going to just go through our testifiers, and then we'll go back to member discussion. So happy to entertain more questions.
Oh, Madam Chair, if I could.
Yes, Representative Davis.
Not for the witness there. I do have to make a disclaimer here, and I want to do that right up front.
Sure.
This is my bill from 2011. It has worked beautifully over the years, and I do have a purpose statement for it. I think we should have a purpose statement that says this bill will close down ambulance services.
Back to our testifiers. Claudia Holt.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and members of the committee for having me today. My name is Claudia Holt, Programs and Strategy Director at Prepare and Prosper here in St. Paul. For over 50 years, Prepare and Prosper has provided quality, free tax preparation to low and moderate income families and individuals. We also offer financial services through volunteer coaching and through our Fair Banking Initiative in partnership with Sunrise Banks, and use the expertise of over 300 trained volunteers to bring financial empowerment, economic justice, and wealth-building opportunities for all Minnesotans. At Prepare and Prosper, we think of tax time as the money moment. For many families, a tax refund is the largest portion of income they will receive all year, sometimes accounting for up to 40% of their total annual income. By subjecting families to revenue recapture practices, we strip them of their ability to make good choices about their financial futures using their tax refunds. For families who live paycheck to paycheck, this money can make or break their financial stability for the coming year. According to Pew Research, 70% of households in the U.S. are constrained by income, have limited savings, and are challenged by debt. A tax refund can present an opportunity to catch up on bills, pay down debt, handle deferred expenses, or establish important emergency savings. In a 2021 University of Chicago survey, 53% of folks with annual incomes under $30,000 who expected to get a refund said they plan to use some of their refund to cover day-to-day expenses. 27% plan to put some of it in savings. The ability to catch up on bills or save for the future helps people weather financial setbacks and is essential to building generational wealth. Tax credits like the Earned Income Tax Credit and Working Family Credit are the largest anti-poverty tools in the U.S., but those credits cannot do their job if the refund never hits a person's bank account. These tax credits are intended to help protect our most economically vulnerable, and people work hard throughout the year to earn them. They should be subjected to the same protections as a person's wages. Revenue recapture is especially harmful in the case of medical debt, which is nearly always unchosen, often foreseen, and can quickly add up to thousands of dollars, especially for someone with high deductible health insurance. Just 2 weeks ago, I met with a single mother at a tax clinic who was worried that any refund she might be eligible for would be recaptured. She was behind on her January rent and was counting on using her tax refund to catch up so that she wouldn't be evicted. Without that tax refund, her options for keeping her apartment would be limited. While she was working to slowly pay down her debt, paying her rent needed to be a priority. A refund should not be thought of as extra money or a windfall. It is the workers' own earnings that they deserve to get back. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak in favor of this legislation.
Thank you for being with us today. Next up is Buck McAlpin. Welcome to the committee. Please just say your name at the beginning of your testimony and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Buck McAlpin. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. I did get a chance to talk to Representative Ryer before the hearing today, and I have been working from Anna with the coalition, and I think Representative Ryer opened it up well, as and Representative David's comment is just replacing and other ideas for this pot. When the Ambulance Association worked on this back in 2009-10, and I think it was 11, as Representative David's looked at, we looked at a way not to put people into hard collections because we felt that wasn't a good tool to use. And you'll find many providers, ambulance providers, don't utilize that. Across the state, there's a mix of government ambulance providers and not-for-profits. There's only about five what I would call truly private ambulance services left. Since COVID, and I know we've held off on some of this bill for the last few years in this conversation. Ambulance services are still struggling across the state, large and small, with just the financial impact. And we receive very little state or federal money to support ambulance operations through that whole process. If it wouldn't have been for payroll protection, many of them would probably be out of business today. But remember, the ambulance industry, we have to respond 24/7. And so we have to transport people regardless of what we call a wall of biopsy or validate that you can pay for your ambulance bill. We just have to transport you and be available. 70 to 80% of our payer mix is Medicare and Medicaid, which pays us at 35 cents on the dollar. So we do depend on that commercial market and what happens there. And I just heard the other day in one of the health committees in the Senate, 93% of our insurance plans are high deductible. So those are the folks, unfortunately, that are being put in revenue recapture, probably to some of the income limits that they talked about. I do know our state association meets monthly in a reimbursement committee, and we aggressively talk about revenue recapture because the Department of Revenue does a really good job auditing us. Most of our providers are audited annually. It's a very extensive process. They look who we have in revenue recapture, and the department also does training annually to be sure that we follow state guidelines and statute around this program. I know the companies that we work with, they really try and not to miss that people on Medicaid are put in there. And most folks, remember, over a six-month period get 4 ambulance notices sent to them. And if they agree to make a payment as low as, I think it's like $25, we don't put them in revenue capture. It sounds like that might not be happening for everybody across the state. But in the ambulance industry, we try not to do that. And then we really try to enroll people in Medicaid. If their income's that low, we would rather get paid for Medicaid than try to wait for 6 years to recapture someone's tax receipt. So I think in closing, Madam Chair and members, that we'll continue to work with Representative Ryer, but it's really the game and some things we're trying to do in the Health Committee that when we take revenue out of that pot, that impacts somebody across the system.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. And I know that, Representative Hewitt serves on the Property Tax Committee and that there are sort of bigger issues in the EMS world that I know he's working on trying to address. And so looking forward to working with you on that moving forward, whether this is a part of the mix or not. So thanks for being here. Finally, Ron Elwood, if you could.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think he is not able to make it.
Sounds good. Well, that concludes folks who I had on the list to testify on House File 1487. If there's anyone else in the audience who wants to come up, we can do that. Otherwise, is there any member discussion? Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the author, I am very curious as to why we're going after ambulance services, but yet the state isn't kicked out of the revenue recapture business. I don't understand why we would shut down ambulance services, but yet the state can do whatever they want on revenue recapture. What? I don't understand.
Representative Ryer.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, the characterization of we are out to shut down the ambulance services is, of course, not the intent of the bill in any way. And in fact, I think I said in my remarks that we're looking at structural issues in our healthcare system, that we're looking at structural under reimbursement across hospitals and ambulance services. And I hold to that. I think that's absolutely the case. So I would just comment that I don't think that that the intent is there that you're speaking of. I would, to me, I drew a line on private services that are using a state resource. And to me, I stand by that. To me, it's not reasonable that a nonprofit, a non-public organization would be using the resources of the state. It makes no sense to me. We wouldn't do that for hotels. We wouldn't do that for other organizations. And yet we're doing it for certain selections of our healthcare system. We need to find a better way. We need to solve the problems. I'm glad that you're committed to the ambulance services, as am I, because without them, people across the cities, the suburbs, rural Minnesota, would be at a loss when they have medical need. But I don't think it should be on the backs of people who, I mean, I have 1,000 people here who earn less than $20,000 a year who were subjected to revenue recapture for ambulance services. That's absolutely not reasonable, and I think we need to solve that.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could Mr. McAlpin come back to, I've got a question for him.
Sure thing. Thanks, Mr. McAlpin. Representative Davis.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm glad to hear it's not the author's intent to shut ambulance services down, but as they shut down, her intent really doesn't matter. Mr. McAlpin, would this bill, if enacted into law, produce a hardship for our ambulance services?
Mr. McAlpin.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Davis. The Senate, there's another Senate version that eliminates it from everybody, and I would say some of the fire-based operations that we work with, especially in rural Minnesota, that have both a tax-based mix and a payer mix, and some of our smaller privates, financially, they do collect enough in this program to offset some of their budget losses.
Representative Davis.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McAlpin, would this be a hardship for some ambulance services?
Mr. McAlpin.
Yes, Madam Chair, and Representative Davis, without some other financial incentives support.
Right, you know, and I'm, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm hoping, because this bill by itself is just horrible, unless it's backed up or replaced with something to replace the loss that ambulance service is going to have. The other issue I think about is, again, okay, get your tax refund, and you got all these bills, and the state is saying, you can pay your other bills, but you don't have to pay your ambulance bill. That you use that service probably saved your life. So even though it's not the author's intent to harm ambulance services, you heard from Mr. McAlpine that it does. The bill hurts ambulance services. And so I'm very, very concerned about that. Over the years, I mean, I remember I'd always get, you know, I did the EMS retirement plan. I did the EMS regulatory board. I did with Roger Cooper, a Democrat from Bird Island. And it was great going to committees because the Democrats would pound the tar out of me, the Republicans would pound the tar out of Roger Cooper, and we get a unanimous vote. And so a lot of this stuff came in over those years, and then I got the Legislator of the Year, and then you had to make up names like Pioneer Award winner. You were making up names for me, and I appreciate that. So I am into ambulance services. I love ambulance services. And to see a bill that on its own hurts them is not acceptable. Now, if we could sit down at the table, Representative Ryer, I thought you and I were friends. And then this, I don't understand.
Thank you, Representative Davis.
I'm hoping that we can work together. And if this is part of the agreement, but it can't be this by itself. So I hope we can work together on some of these things, because the last thing, I know it's not your intent to hurt the ambulance services, but the bill does. Unless there's other things going on to backfill. And that's, I guess, a discussion for another day. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. It sounds like Representative Davis wants to get in on our discussions about what our public obligation is to those using our healthcare system. So I think we might be able to find some common ground there in saying that he wants the government actually to take on a bigger role in paying for these services. So,
Madam Chair,
yes, I did not
Representative
say
Ryer.
Like that. That's not what I said, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I heard that too.
Representative Ryer,
I guess
when you're suggesting that you make up for the revenue in another place, I'm not sure what else that might constitute. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In all seriousness, going back to the history of this, it actually goes back before your bills. 1999 was when revenue recapture was first made available to the private hospitals that leased. And 2003 was when ambulance services were added. And the conversations were about, can we put up a fund to cover this? And it was rejected as an idea to not have the types of compensating care that you're talking about, that Mr. McAlpin's talking about. if they're, you know, so we walked away from that under a different mindset back 20-odd years ago, and I just want to make sure the record is clear about that and that we're looking at all our alternatives, because my interest is protecting the people who should have autonomy on how they spend their money. And I would argue that paying a medical bill when you're about to be evicted and you really need to pay your rent or you need to feed your children is the devil's choice of options. It's really cruel. And I know cruelty is not intended, but the impact of it is harsh on the people who are being harmed by this. So I would love to find a solution that makes us all happy. And keep in mind, this will be going to health. We will have time to discuss it.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. I believe that they're hearing the bill informationally in health, and it's kind of staying with us because we're laying it over today, just to clarify that. Representative Swedzinski, we got a list, so everybody be patient, but I'll get to you all.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, and I'm going to make more of a statement, you know, just from the folks from the ambulance services and that, you know, if folks' bills don't get paid, which they say, well, there's an option, they can go to private collections and whatnot. And we know how that normally goes with a lot of different bills being paid. You know, this at the end of the day will rise the cost of health care and ambulance services for other people. Because, you know, these businesses don't operate on their own. If people don't want to pay their own bills, then someone else is going to have to. And so everyone else is going to have higher bills, higher costs of health care if this passes. Because the costs and the burdens won't fall on the people that actually utilize the service, but the other folks that have to pick the bill up. And, you know, that needs to be part of the conversation as well, too.
All right. Thank you for that. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First a comment and a question. To the notion that if we were to do this, this would bankrupt our ambulance services. I think all of us want our ambulance and services to work well, but just the point of if this revenue recapture piece is so vital to the financing of our and health of our ambulance services, boy, then we've got more problems than we can shake a fist at. I'm glad that we do need to have a broader conversation and can't have this one in a vacuum. But my question specifically to the practice of revenue capture and the consumer protection piece of this. You know, I know that there was an extensive Star Tribune article that covered many Minnesotans that they had no idea that they owed money and were caught in this revenue recapture process. We've heard countless stories about sort of surprise billing or people getting billed from a hospital incorrectly. And I'm just curious, what are the sort of rights of folks that get caught in the system and sort of the accountability check about whether they actually owe this money in the first place? How it's been described, I guess I have concerns without due process that, you know, there's one issue of having people pay the bills you're owed, but another issue folks are having revenue recaptured and there might even be a mistake. And so I'm wondering if the author would comment on that.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Howard. I'll comment briefly, but I'd also invite my testifier, Ms. Odegaard, to come down. Briefly, with revenue recapture, there is no check on whether or not it's a valid bill. The hospital, in many cases, or the ambulance provider, sends it to the Department of Revenue, who pays it.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Ms. Odegaard, did you have something to contribute on that note?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to point out that Joanna Bears from the Department of Revenue is here and may be able to offer a more detailed answer. Pretty much everything I know about it, I learned from her and her team.
Representative Howard, if Representative Ryer covered your question.
If Ms. Bars, anything to add, that would be great, but I that does answer my question. So
I think we're okay. I think we took care of that without calling Ms. Bears up to the tribunal here. Representative Joy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Same question, a couple things as I'm writing notes here and we're talking about things Representative Ryer brought up the thing that it's, you know, the average person is like $20,000 that are dealing with this, is what one of the comments that was made. And so when you talk about that, and you talk about a 5.35% tax, you know, that's about $1,070 they get back every year. What percent of the people making the $20,000 you referred to have a high deductible plan that this affects and comes back to them? I'm kind of curious if we have percentages on that, first of all.
I would be surprised if she did, but I'm going to go to her and see. Representative Ryer, if you have information about the health care plans of the people who are subject to revenue recapture for medical debt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I'll say two things. One, the very lowest income people shouldn't even be experiencing revenue recapture because of their income. Most of them are probably below, and that calls into question the level of screening that's being done, and I'm preparing a different bill on that. So the other thing is that we know that many, many people in the commercial market have high deductible plans, but I don't have that data available because the data I have are strictly based on the claims and not tied to their benefits.
Representative Joy.
Okay, just one more thing too, Madam Chair. Being a local mayor, and we owned our PUC, and we used to do revenue recapture on when people didn't pay their utilities and stuff like that. And we had a process in place, and I actually felt it worked really good. And the people knew they didn't pay their utility bills when they left, and they knew that it was going to hit when they got a refund, you know. So I would be interested in learning more about how this is different than what we used at the city level. I would assume would probably be the same revenue recapture than what we're seeing there. And I guess I'm surprised when I hear that people didn't know they're getting and all of a sudden their refund's taken away, because everybody we notified and let them know, they knew what was coming when they moved out of the area. And so thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ryer.
Madam Chair, Representative, sorry. Two things about that. One, I think that in many cases when we're looking at revenue recapture for healthcare, we may be looking at a more mobile population. And mail does not follow well necessarily. And so just the tracking down of people can be harder. And I would like to commend you for having a revenue recapture program that was apparently set up the way it should be, with communication and accountability. And if everyone worked that well, then fewer people at least would be surprised. They might not be happy, but maybe they'd be less surprised.
Representative Joy? Okay. Next, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So last time I rode in an ambulance was in 2017. I broke this elbow in an automobile accident, and the ambulance ride from Eden Prairie to St. Louis Park cost $2,500. I think that's pretty typical, actually, and I was lucky in a sense in that I had already exhausted my deductible on cancer surgery early in the year, so the insurance company paid for it. But yeah, a number of you know are doing a lot of work right now related to price transparency in the healthcare industry, and just as we're sitting here, I happen to be putting together a little presentation on the topic. I'll give you an example of a procedure that I've had, a CAT scan that I had every year or twice a year for 5 years to make sure my cancer hadn't returned. And the price of that CT scan at Regents Hospital is $302. You go to Abbott Northwestern, it's $925. You go to the Mayo Clinic, it's $1,047. And these are the cash prices to somebody who doesn't have insurance. You layer on the differences in the prices of you would pay if you did have insurance. It is completely arbitrary. So what bothers me most about this process is that you're denying the person with this bill the ability to challenge the bill, negotiate the payment. You're just saying whatever the hospital says the bill is, that's what you've got to pay, even if it's $1,000 for something that the hospital across the street would cost $300 for.
Thank you. Up next, Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank the author for bringing forward this bill and apologize. I had to step out in the hallway to talk to testifiers for my bill. So I missed part of your presentation, but from my understanding, when we've heard this in the past, the revenue we capture for underlying entities such as public entities and city councils still stay intact, that what we're removing is the ability for a private company to utilize our Department of Revenue to capture revenue from folks who are paying a bill. Is that accurate?
Representative Ryer.
Madam Chair, 100% accurate, Representative Joachim.
Madam Chair,
quick follow-up or maybe an answer to a question. I, too, sat on a city council, and it always annoyed the crap out of me that some people wouldn't pay their utility bills as standard practice, and just even some of our I come from a city that's 65% rental, and some of our property owners, that's just how they did business. But cities have the ability to assess on people's property taxes to recapture that, too. So I believe that's mostly just an assessment onto that. It's not a recapture of revenue. It's just you're assessed on your taxes. So that's a quick answer.
Thank you. Representative Olson, B.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Representative Ryer. You stated that you have a list of 1,000 individuals who you don't think should have to pay their ambulance bill. My question is, who do you believe should pay their ambulance bill for them?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Olson. I think we need to reform the healthcare system so that the unreasonable amounts that they may be charged are not hitting them when they aren't able to pay. So that's a structural thing. And in the immediate case, I would turn to you and say, if these people didn't have the funds in their tax returns and that money was not paid, what would your solution be?
Representative Olson.
Well, thank you for the question, Representative Ryer. It's not my bill that we're talking about. But I would just say that it's very important when we're looking at, I agree, there's a structural issue that needs to be addressed here, but it's very important not to pull a stool out from someone when they're attempting to sit down. This will very much hurt our ambulance systems. Let's not pull the stool out from under them before we have an answer. Like, let's replace the stool with something else so the ambulance system does not have to call the ambulance because they've broken themselves.
Thank you. I'll just note that's the second time that this has sort of come up, but this bill isn't like the you shouldn't pay your bills bill. This is the question that's being answered in this bill is, should we be using a public mechanism that was set up using a state agency that was set up to recapture bills that are owed to government entities? Should we use that mechanism to go after debt that's owed to private companies, which is diverges from the practice in general? So, sorry, I probably shouldn't be editorializing, but Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. I understand this because most Minnesotans are facing 40-year highs in inflation, so we're all feeling the pain of that. The question I would have, or if you would be interested in, if they are they don't pay their bill for a period of time, would then this kick in, or would it not apply at that time? Let's say they do have a payment plan. So that was really good testimony to hear that they pay the $25. So if at that point they hadn't paid it for a period of time, could this clause kick in or no? There's no way to recoup that money.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. If I understand you, in the case of these private organizations that are making use of our government processes, they would not have that option anymore, that they would need to go to other alternatives or help the patient find other funding sources.
Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. I understand that part. I guess then concerns me when we talk about housing, you got to make these tough choices, is if it goes on their credit report, it's going to affect if they get kicked out of their housing because of that's an issue, and then that's brought up at the next time they got to be a lease. So I feel like there could be some unintended consequences in that. I was just trying to find a solution. It was more than anything. I'm not trying to get a blurb out there. I'm just trying to look for a solution that would work, and So thank you for the question.
Thank you. Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. I appreciate that. One of the things that I think we need to look more closely at is the federal legislation, because I saw a headline very recently that medical debt no longer is going on credit reports. And what I can't tell you sitting here is whether there are exceptions to that, but I believe that it's a fairly strong policy, and you can correct me if you know more.
Thank you, Representative Breyer. So we have three more. We have 7 minutes. We have three folks on the list. So we're going to go quickly to Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a great bill. Thank you, Representative, for bringing it forward. But I think it is important to kind of step back. So in these detailed discussions, I think we miss some larger issues that we have with our terrible healthcare system. And the first, just basically, and this very basic part of this discussion, is the idea of medical debt, that we live in this society, in a wonderful society, where we think that people should have to pay and get into medical debt so that they can care for those they love, for their families, and that is the leading cause of bankruptcy in our country, in our wonderful country. So just on a larger scale, this is a terrible fact that we need to deal with. Zoom in a little further, we have in our system right now an insurance industry that is making record profits. Our biggest healthcare provider in our nation is United Health. They made $5 billion in profits in 2022, in profits, and that is a 28% increase in 2021. So there's money in the system for us to make sure things are working, but they're not going to services, they're going to insurance claims, itemizing these services, which is how this medical debt comes to being. Now we're zooming in even further, and we're talking about people who are struggling, not being able to get their tax returns, and using the mechanisms of the state, our very Department of Revenue, to collect on those debts, including tax credits that we all support and love, things like the Working Family Tax Credit that we are hearing and maybe expanding, are not going to go to people who are working and have children that need that tax credit, but it's going to go to ambulance services or whoever else needs it. If that's how we're going to run our healthcare system, as Representative Howard said, we got way bigger issues than this. So this particular bill, I think, is an obvious slam dunk that we don't want to use the Department of Revenue of our state to take money from people who are already struggling in a bad economy, but even broadly, this is another small illustration of how badly we need to work, and that's in taxes, that's in healthcare, all over the place, to make healthcare in our state and our country much better. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am going to ride on the coattails of Rep. Smith and just share some thoughts from the conversation here. I first want to acknowledge that, you know, our healthcare system is seriously flawed, right? And we are not paying for the accurate value of the services that we're receiving. This is why a lot of private equity firms have been buying up ambulance firms, right? So there's a big problem with, you know, how we pay for folks to get to hospitals, and also I like to use this term in the one of the richest countries in the world, you know, we should not have medical debt. You know, folks should have access to the health care services that they need. And I say this because, you know, I pay for the roads that all of our legislators drive on, right? And we don't parse out, you know, like the foot of the street that, you know, folks drive on when they are in St. Paul, because these are public goods. So I want us to, right, step back and think about where we want to put our public dollars. And this is important because if you actually read the revenue note, if Ryer's bill passes, we free up one FTE at the Department of Revenue to do more things, because we already tasked the Department of Revenue with a lot of things that, you know, we know that our MATE members and our civil servants, you know, are overworked and underpaid. And so I want us to think about the consumer piece of this that I think is being lost. I understand this is a business, right? Hospitals need to run. We have to pay for ambulance services. But, you know, this is why we have third-party debt collectors to do their job. That is a business, and we should not be using taxpayer dollars to do the work of, you know, big healthcare companies that have the billions in profits to pay for their own debt collectors. And with that, I'll give it back to the chair.
Thank you. Representative Davids.
Thank you. I'd like to talk about House File 1487. Representative Ryer made a comment that to Representative Joy that, well, the cities are doing it right because they know that this is coming. Well, the folks that aren't paying their ambulance bills are notified, I think, four or five times. So you made the comment, Representative Ryer, that they don't know about it. They know about it. And I think when it all what it all boils down to from the testimony we had that this bill harms ambulance services, and I'm not willing to do that.
Thank you. Not seeing any further discussion on the bill, Representative Ryer, did you have anything to close us out?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to all members for your comments and discussion. The bill before us is one that is focused on appropriate use of government resources. It's focused on appropriate treatment of Minnesotans. There are many ways in which our healthcare system is flawed. This addresses one piece of it. And from my point of view, I will welcome any future conversations about it, but stand behind this as an inequitable approach that every other state that has done it, save one, has rejected and walked away from because they've said, this isn't who we are, this isn't how we treat our people. Thank you, and I'm glad to have been here.
Thank you. And with that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 1487 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill, and 1487 is laid over. So that's the end of our time together. For the rest of the week, tomorrow we are lending our time once again to Representative Lislegard, who needs lots of our time. And then on Thursday, he looks thrilled about it, too. We're going to have a good time tomorrow on property taxes, everybody. Don't worry. Then on Thursday, we're going to hear a couple of construction materials exemptions projects, including the full package. So with that, we will see you Thursday, and we're adjourned.